They still have their problems. The police departments, they get stonewalled by the city manager, and they haven't got any disciplinary powers, and their staffing has been cut way back. But we talked to the chair of that board, Aaron Handel, in a lengthy interview. Aaron is also a former activist, so there's something. It's really hard to find any activists on the police review board who are doing anything at all. We had John Malkin, who actually helped form the board back in the early 90s. He was on the coalition to establish the Police Review Commission, but he quit because he thought the board was ineffective, because he was being harassed by police chief, by the officers, by investigations of his political views, and not supported by the board. And he actually publishes an interesting letter on that issue in the SCAN newsletter, which I wish I had, and perhaps I'll read to you in the next show. But until then, let's turn to what Aaron Handel of Berkeley has to say about his police review board. I think we can gain something by considering it, because, I mean, there's been a lot of serious... the blinds have been opened here in terms of what the police review board really is in Santa Cruz, which is worse than a fig leaf. It's embarrassing how totally useless it seems to be, even in the most serious case. And should we support strengthening the board? Does this mean, is it going to do any good with a city council that isn't interested in any kinds of police abuses against poor people? And John Dine was a poor person. He was shot dead. An innocent man, as Santa Cruzans for Full Disclosure says, and I believe to be true. Maybe we shouldn't be considering strengthening the police review board. Maybe we should be doing our own independent cop-watching organizations. Maybe we should be demonstrating and marching and looking for citizen control of police departments, breaking up the police department into radically changing its format. That was considered in Berkeley in the early 70s. Didn't pass, but it got close, almost passed. They were going to split the police department up into three different community-based sections. And actually, they passed the police review board section of that bill, but they didn't pass the rest of it. Anyway, let's hear what Aaron Handel has to say, and maybe we can gain some thoughts. I've got to warn you at the beginning, Aaron. Aaron's activist days seem to be a bit behind him at the moment. Perhaps the dangers of an institutional position is you tend to sound more and more like a bureaucrat, and I'm afraid there is that aspect to it. But listen to what he has to say and see if you can learn something here.
It's about noon. We're calling back Aaron Handel of the Citizens Police Review Board. Well, we're talking to Aaron Handel, a Police Review Commission member in Berkeley. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, Robert. How you doing? Good to be with you.
Hey, I'm glad we got you on the phone. Last time we talked to you, I think we were wandering about People's Park talking.
I remember the Norsemen of the North with a tape recorder in People's Park, yes.
Right, stuck to one hand like a glove, I guess.
Uh-huh.
So how long have you been on the board now?
Oh, I guess it's been probably about 4 years now.
And you've had an abiding interest in police review and keeping a close watch on police conduct even before you were on the board.
Well, that's true. I used to attend police review commission meetings for a couple of years before I was actually appointed to the commission.
And you yourself have been involved in protest action to guarantee civil rights of poor people in Berkeley. Is that accurate?
Well, I think that's absolutely true. I've been involved in a number of political activities.
So has much changed in the 4 years of your tenure on the Berkeley Police Review Commission?
Well, has much changed? Well, let me talk about some of the things that have changed. Berkeley Police Review Commission, since I've been on the commission, has had some difficulty in staffing. It's almost been a revolving door. Our PRC officer recently resigned, and we've had investigators come and go without any real stability. And that can be a serious problem because there's no institutional memory. Our staff doesn't remember what the precedents are because they're new. They weren't there.
How many staff members do you have on average?
Well, let me tell you the good news. We have just hired a PRC officer. Her name is Barbara Tard, and she has been serving as the assistant director of the OCC in San Francisco.
I think I know her, actually. I met her about 8 years ago when she came down to Santa Cruz when we were considering ourselves trying to put together a police review board.
Yes, uh-huh. We have also hired an investigator. Her name is Lee Kaplan, and prior to working for the PRC, she was a legal aid attorney. She speaks Spanish, and she used to work at the Berkeley Community Law Center. So we are rebuilding the Berkeley Police Review Commission. We're getting good staff people who aren't just there make money, but really care about the job that they're doing.
Now, Berkeley is a city of, what, 120,000 people?
Oh, approximately, yeah.
And so the number of staff members you have on average on your board is, what, two or three or something?
It has varied. Back in 1994, we had a total of 6 staff members. The situation has been such that the budget has been cut financially, and we've finally begun to turn things around where I think we'll now have a pretty good staff, but the decline has been going on for several years now. We've only recently begun to stop the hemorrhaging. I think we've turned the corner and get back on track to being kind of mission that we ought to be.
So you have, what, 3 or 4 staff members now, or?
Let's see. We have the PRC officer, Barbara Tard. We have the investigator, Lee Kaplan, and then we have a secretarial staff, Gwen Aaron and Rhonda, and so we have a pretty good team.
How many complaints a year do you get on average?
Well, that's also something that varies. I know it's been... There have been years when it's been over 100 complaints. There have been other years when it's been as little as 50.
Mm-hmm.
Last year we had a slight increase over the previous year. I hope that we're going to be doing more community outreach in the future.
You know, it's interesting for those listeners who are listening to this show on Free Radio Santa Cruz, the difference between the Berkeley board and the Santa Cruz board are, of course, very significant. Your Berkeley board is a much older board. It was formed in the early 70s.
Yeah, the oldest civilian review body in the United States. We're celebrating our 25th anniversary this year.
And, of course, you were also formed with much more power than you were eventually allowed to have. You originally had disciplinary powers.
That's true. An appellate court struck out some of the language of the ordinance that established the Police Review Commission. However, I think in a number of respects, we've got a lot of good things going for us. We are a very public commission. Everything we do is public.
Unlike in Santa Cruz, where all police files are viewed in private behind closed doors, and you there is a provision in our board for a public hearing, but the board in its 2 or 3 years of existence has refused to use that provision in spite of repeated requests from complainants. And it's particularly egregious in the most recent case where, of course, a man was shot dead by a police officer, and every non-police witness said that the original police story, which came out of both the police department and the district attorney's office, namely that the victim was holding a gun, pointing it at the police, threatening them, and assuming a combat stance, that story was completely false. That was not, let's say, in accord with what the 10 other independent witnesses saw.
Uh-huh. I really don't know anything about the facts of that case.
No, I don't expect you to. I'm just saying that it's interesting that your board has public hearings,
sure,
even on relatively minor matters, right?
Every board of inquiry is public, and there are a variety of models of civilian review. It sounds to me like your board down there in Santa Cruz is more like the University of California's Police Review Board.
Or let's say their Phantom Police Review Board?
Well, the one at UC, they hadn't convened since 1994. They did so recently in response to the April 28th incident at Sproul Hall,
which
where
pepper spraying incident.
Pepper sprayed and struck with batons. In fact, I just showed the videotape of that incident to the Alameda County Human Relations Commission, and they're very much concerned about it. I've also been talking to the U.S. Department of Justice about that incident.
I'm going to ask you more about that in a moment, but has the board of the so-called Police Review Board of the University of California at Berkeley taken any action of any significance?
Well, it's kind of interesting. On the surface, University of California officials are in complete denial. The internal affairs investigation of this incident found that there was no misconduct. All officers were exonerated. However, we have the videotape. The videotape was shown by the Berkeley City Council. They watched four times. I think it's fair to say that all of the council members were shocked at what is shown on this videotape.
Describe what is shown, Aaron.
Well, it's a lot can happen in 2 minutes. Among other things, a young student was pepper sprayed in the face within inches from his face. Simultaneously, he was struck in the stomach with a baton, swung like a baseball bat into his stomach as he was being pepper sprayed within inches from his face.
Has this student been convicted of any crime, and has he sued civilly and around any of this stuff?
None of the students have been convicted of any crimes, to my knowledge. There's a possibility there may have been a couple of trespass pleas. I'm not sure about that, but certainly the most serious crime alleged is trespass in a public building, I might add. Let me continue on with what happened to this one particular student after being struck in the stomach and pepper sprayed in the face. He turned around, and you can see this all on the videotape. He was then struck in the back with a baseball-like swing, struck him in his back. He then fell to the ground and then was pummeled with a full overhand strike as he lay on the ground. Numerous students were beaten with batons as they lay on the ground, having been sprayed with pepper spray already. So,
sounds like a Rodney King training film, Aaron.
Well, our commission intervened. We held a public hearing at the Student Senate Chambers of Eshelman Hall. There were more than 100 people present, many of them students, one of them wearing a cast who had a broken arm. After hearing the testimony of the students, looking at photographs, reviewing the videotape, our commission found that there was, in fact, substantial evidence of excessive force.
But in fact, your commission has no real jurisdiction over UC Berkeley police, right?
Well, jurisdiction is a word that has certain legal connotations. Written into our ordinance, the Police Review Commission does, in fact, have the authority to review and make recommendations regarding the practices and policies of any law enforcement agency that operates in the city of Berkeley.
Does that include private security guards?
Well, are they a law enforcement agency? I would say they are not. Historically, the PRC has, on occasion, looked at the activities of private security. And there is a connection with municipal government. Apparently, there's some kind of a certification process and I think there's a local ordinance in Berkeley that regulates security guards to some extent. So there are ways that the PRC can look at private security, and they have in the past.
It's interesting you say they have, because in Santa Cruz, such complaints are regularly dismissed, turned away, or told that they're not relevant. If it involves, for example, what we call the Seaside Corporation goon squads, the Pacific, the PSI security that patrols the Metro Transit Center.
Let's make the distinction between a complaint process and examining policies and practices. That we can certainly do.
Right. I follow that distinction, but even I think that it shows a concern by your board that is somewhat more
more wide-reaching than our board, because
I think it reflects the ordinance, which in turn reflects the will of the voters back in 1972.
Now, are your members are appointed by council members or elected?
We are appointed by members of the council who are elected.
Uh-huh. We have the same process, and we found recently in the board's complete exoneration of the police chief and the officer Connor Carey, who shot Happy John Dine on November 12th, in their exoneration.
So there was some kind of investigation?
There was no investigation. There was only their standard process of closed hearings around the issue of what the police department themselves did in terms of investigation, and to some extent, the district attorney's office.
I guess they don't understand the process of your police review board. How can an officer be exonerated if there has been no investigation?
Well, they don't have it. They call themselves, as the chair is fond of explaining, we are not an investigatory body, we are a reviewing body. We review what the police department itself has done in terms of an investigation.
Tell me, your police review board does not have the power to investigate incidents?
It has the power to hold public hearings, it has the power to subpoena officers and testimony, it has even the power to seek from the city manager an appointed independent investigator who will go out and investigate. But it refused to exercise any of those powers, and in fact has refused to do that throughout its tenure.
Well, doesn't sound like a very effective body.
That's understating it by a mile.
Steve.
Yep.
Okay, well, let's make another understatement. It's like there's room for improvement.
Hey. What kind of improvement would you suggest? Well, I'd say not just for our body, but there are those who said the Citizens Police Review Board of Berkeley lacks teeth,
sure,
partially because of its lack of staffing, and you pointed out how that problem has been a problem, but also because of, city manager obstruction. That was particularly true around the early part of the decade when there was a lot of complaints coming out of the police attacks on people around People's Park, right?
Well, there are a lot of factors that come into play. I would agree with you that the Berkeley Police Review Commission lacks teeth. Yes, it could be much more effective, much more powerful. There are limitations imposed by state law, the Police Officer's Procedural Bill of Rights. There are limitations imposed by an appellate court that took out some of the strong points of the ordinance that established the Berkeley Police Review Commission. And, Robert, most importantly, there are self-imposed limitations that members of the Police Review Commission, or any civilian review body for that matter, make the commission only as effective as they want it to be. And if you have people on the commission who are concerned about the rights of citizens, integrity of the civilian review process, they are much more likely to try to make the commission as effective as possible within its limited parameters. So I think that's a variable that citizens do have some control over. They can work to get good people on civilian review boards, people who really want to utilize and make it effective.
Well, now, in Berkeley, you, of course, at the last election, you had a change in the composition of the Berkeley City Council when it shifted from bad to better.
Yes.
And I know that it's not been, I wouldn't want to say good, because your council has stonewalled on the issue of pepper spray, I know, which has been a matter of some concern to your board.
One of the biggest improvements that we had was the the early departure of Carla Woodworth and the election of Councilmember Chris Worthington.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll have to say that Councilmember Worthington's appointees on the Police Review Commission have been outstanding. We had Mark Schlossberg, a student at UC who is now attending law school at New York University. He was a really great asset to the commission. Following his going to school at New York University, Chris then appointed Jess, who has been equally outstanding. Jess was actually instrumental in putting together the the motion that dealt with subpoena of police reports on pepper spray. So,
but the city council so far has remained unwilling to bar pepper spray in Berkeley or even to significantly restrict it?
Well, that is correct. You know, it seems that the votes are there for something stronger than what we currently have, but they can't seem to negotiate 5 votes that would agree on the language of any increased restriction on the use of pepper spray.
Now, how, let me, for the benefit of Santa Cruzans, explain the differences between your board and the Santa Cruz board very quickly. The Santa Cruz board considers complaints after the Internal Affairs Department of the police have looked at them, and they essentially look at the files from the police department investigation. They do so in closed session. They have the power, as I said before, to open that up through calling for public hearings, and the complainant can call for public hearings as well, as some of us have, and of course they've chosen to ignore that call, or actually to turn it down. They also have the power to order an early independent investigation even previous to the police department's investigation, and they can order an investigation independent of and in addition to the police department investigation, which they've never done. The entire board meets. They don't have this system which you have as of smaller subcommittees of the board meeting, and they meet, as I say, in closed session. And then they bring their results out, which don't tell us anything about why they decided what they decided, simply that you know, that a complaint was either sustained, unsustained, exonerated, or unfounded. Now, your board, on the other hand, has, you're saying, has public meetings of its subcommittees which consider each of the complaints?
All meetings are public. The boards of inquiry consist of a 3-member panel of the Police Review Commission. Technically a subcommittee, it is a board of inquiry composed of 3 members.
Mm-hmm.
And it rotates from complaint to complaint. You'll have different board members serving on those boards of inquiry. In addition to that, we of course have the power to establish subcommittees. We currently have a permanent standing subcommittee called the Community Outreach Subcommittee that has been very active in a
right. Well, let me ask you this. Here, recently, there's been a whirlwind of criticism against the Police Review Board here, not just because of its strange activity, in my mind, in the Happy John Dine case. It's not so much that they found the wrong decision. It's that they insisted on a closed process when even the city council had indicated that were the board to come to it to request open hearings, actually they don't even have to request open hearings, they can hold them, but let's say an independent investigation, which might require more funding, the council would be agreeable to doing that. Even though council members had privately indicated that to the staff of the Citizens Police Review Board, and actually some council members had publicly stated that, this board simply found, in spite of flagrant contradictions between statements of police witnesses and all the non-police witnesses, that it didn't require any further investigation. It didn't even require cross-examining the witnesses in public hearings. So that was a concern of many of us. But another concern has been that the board's most, let's say, militant members, and that's actually a word that isn't really properly applied to Citizens Police Review Board members, there haven't been any real advocates, in my mind, and I've been to many of their meetings. There have been kind of folks who are less likely to let the police schmooze them to death, if you want to put it that way. But there have been no, for example, members of civil liberties organizations on the board. There was one member of the commission to create the Citizens Police Review Board, a man named John Malkin, who I think you probably spoke with at some point.
Yeah.
And John resigned after he found the board was useless, and he also found he was being investigated by the police department for his political affiliations and his public statements, and that the board was actually considering censuring him instead of supporting him, simply because he was, for example, defending his right to do outreach in communities where the police chief stood up and criticized the board, and he then responded to criticisms of the police chief and was accused of being critical of the police chief, unduly so.
Well, Robert, let me just say in general, and I really can't go into detail about your police review board because
right.
I know a little about it, but generally speaking, it seems to me that unless a civilian review agency has a public process, they're not going to enjoy public credibility. Those two things seem to me to be inextricably linked.
Now, what about San Francisco? Does the Office of Citizen Complaints over there, or Civilian Complaints, have a public process?
Good point. It is somewhat different. The OCC functions more like an internal affairs section. They have had serious problems with their credibility and public confidence in the past. However, as the result of a voter initiative and a great deal of public pressure, they've made substantial improvements, including the hiring of a very diverse staff that reflects the San Francisco community, at least much better than it used to. And they've become, I think it's fair to say, they've become more vigorous in their pursuit of investigations. I think their public credibility has increased as a consequence.
But now,
you're quite right about the public process. I don't know, I'm not familiar enough with the OCC. I really don't know how much of what they do is in public and how much is not. So
I think you're the only board in California that I know of, and possibly in the West Coast. I don't want to go so far as to say the country, because I think there may be one or two others that actually has a public process. I mean, do you know of any other boards that, I mean...
Well, I think there are many others that do. I think there's also a distinction between the complaint process and between dealing with policy and practice issues. There certainly is no reason why any civilian review body cannot discuss policy matters in a public setting. Certainly no restriction under state law or for any other reason why they shouldn't be able to do that. Since we're talking about public policy, it seems logical that it should be discussed publicly.
And hopefully some of us will be bringing to our own police review board broader policy concerns. Actually, this board just decided 2 months ago that they had the right to make comments on policy statements. They've been so timid on the issue that for the last 3 years, they haven't made any policy statements.
You know, it's always a struggle everywhere you go. It's civilian review is constantly under attack, and it needs to have strong public support to make it more effective. So I don't know much about the situation in Santa Cruz. It seems to me like
well, let's turn to Berkeley.
Let me just mention.
Sure, go ahead.
One thing that seems that it would be helpful is to get your council members to appoint some good people to that police review board that are interested in actually exercising powers that it has.
It also would be good to get some good council members, and that's, of course...
Can't put the cart before the horse, I guess.
Right. Well, perhaps we'll have an epidemic of flu that wipes out the current council. That's always a hope.
Well, I don't know if that's the best way to do it.
Probably not.
Good ones also, so... Flu won't do it, but I think effective electoral campaigns might be a good strategy.
Maybe they'll all be appointed to state offices, because many of them seem to be politicians angling for just that kind of approach. But I'm not going to draw you into that discussion. How could the Berkeley board be made more efficient? I know you said that back in the early 70s, the board's power to review and engage in disciplinary function of the police department was taken away by a court. Couldn't that be, voted on by the voters by a charter amendment, and have that process renewed and resumed?
It was voted on by a city ordinance that had the force of law, and that's what was portions of which were struck down.
Right. Well, my understanding of that, I'm not entirely clear. Although I did read a bit of the debate at the time, was that the vote was a city law, but it was not a charter amendment. They needed a charter amendment or some such thing. That it went further than us. The city law would not do it.
Well, you might have something there. Charter amendment. I think it requires a two-thirds vote. A huge campaign, tremendous amount of money. You ready to come up here and help?
I will be happy to write a flyer on the subject whenever you give me the word, Aaron.
All right. Yeah.
If you could see the earth saw that it had died. No animals or birds or trees, only poison there to breathe. Deadly rains and lifeless seas, it's the end of history. Would you ask who let this happen? Would you think it was insane? No one stopped the murder of a planet and a race. Is this to be our legacy? An epitaph no one will read. They would not save their history, their children, their eternity.
And you are tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is Bath Robespierre's Broadsides, 2.5 hours of civil rights, civil wrongs. Your voice on the air if you want to call in at 423-5361. And particular focus on the rights of people outside, people on the streets, people without houses or permanent abodes. People, in other words, who usually get the shaft from local authorities and people fighting back against that kind of injustice. I'll be here for till 1:30. This is a show you can usually catch every Sunday at 11 and Thursday at 6 in the evening.
Woo-hoo!
On Free Radio Santa Cruz. And there are actually some other good shows around the same subject. You can catch it other times. I thought I want to give you kind of a brief rundown on those. Of course, the show that follows mine, Fucking It Up in a Fucked Society, Music and Issues for Brainwashed Children, has Old Reckless running you through some stuff, but she actually has some decent music on her show. So if you get tired of my old musical selections and ancient creaky folk singers, well, you should tune in for her, 1:30 on Sunday. What else we got? Well, Monday, 7:30, Feel Free, Resist Locally, Local Issues of Resistance. That's 7:30 to 9 on Free Radio Santa Cruz on Monday. Recommend you tune in on what he's up to. Plenty of good shows, but Food Not Bombs Radio Network, Wednesday, 8 to 8:30. That's a regular tape that's broadcast from, comes out of San Francisco, I believe. Then, of course, on Thursday, tune in with me again, 6 to 8, Bath Robespierre's Broadsides again. And Uncle Dennis, Earth First, some of those issues are local. And then on Friday, Independent Landscapes and Soiled Underwear, particularly tasteful commentary in the longest chunk of radio time that anybody in our studio is allowed to have, probably because he's sleeping with everybody in the entire collective. That's Skidmark Bob, 9 p.m. to 2 a.m. And then on Saturday, lots of stuff, but again, not a lot on the issues that interest me in terms of civil rights on the streets. But now we got an incoming phone call. Let's see what's happening here.
Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Hi, Robert. This is David here.
Hey, David, Council Watcher Silva.
Yeah, thanks to the scan newsletter, it's a little easier to watch the council.
Uh-huh.
They finally got that act together. They've been talking about it for a long time.
Uh-huh.
I've been trying to do this new thing where you can get the city council agenda on, across the internet, and I was right there, and then, I don't know, somehow I went back to the other thing, and I lost the screen. But somewhere on the agenda this Tuesday, I guess Phil was going to be talking about it, the Beach Flats relocation.
Yeah, that's the redevelopment session of the city council at 5 o'clock on Tuesday.
So it's in the redevelopment agency section?
Mm-hmm.
Item number 4, was it?
I believe, and let me double-check on my schedule, it is item number 4. Yeah, relocation policy, it's called.
Yeah, well, that I think that policy, I haven't seen it. I haven't seen what they've got developed. I have talked in the past to the Planning Commission and to the Planning Commissioner, and I've talked to different people. There's also, a committee of SCAN that has been watching this pretty closely. In fact, in the SCAN newsletter, there's a letter, to the City Council, just telling them to watch their P's and Q's. But I think what we got a situation here that this is really going to probably be the red letter day, so to speak. We need to either to be there and find out what they're going to do to actually guarantee that people aren't kicked out into the streets. And if they're not going to do anything that's really a guarantee, that's really very clear, set in stone, that people will not be put out in the streets, that they will be given housing if their place is demolished or whatever all the relocation is going to do. And there's a lot of development basically. You know, I'm calling it the, so far, until they prove otherwise, I'm calling it the development of Little Miami and all the evils that goes along with Miami. So until they actually put a policy in place that's real clear, I think we're going to have to count on the candidates that we got coming up for city council. So if they don't put something in place, then it's going to be, it should become like the number one litmus test for scan endorsements, for Green Party endorsements, People's Democratic Club endorsements for these candidates, because it's basically they're going to be, it sounds to me like they're asking us to trust them, just to trust them, and I haven't seen much to trust lately.
Well, you know, are we then to wait until next November? Does that mean we get a year of trash from these folks, or would you suggest a recall campaign?
I don't think schedule-wise, time-wise, it's a recall is possible. It just you know.
But remember, most of these people are not up for election in '98.
Well, this is true. But I think we focus on the election first. I think that we can count on Catherine Byers, you know, coming from the heart when it comes to the relocation issue. And I think we can count on Celia Scott of being very, very clear and precise on the relocation issue.
That's
All we need is to elect two more, which this election coming up allows us to do.
Yeah, but can't they essentially savage that process before November?
No.
Oh, they can't?
No.
Okay, well, I thought that they would be making decisions in the next few months that would have a crucial impact.
And different things. It seems to me what they've got in
place. Can't they rezone? Can't they rezone and give the green light to the Seaside Company by March?
Well, I'm not following you exactly. What I'm saying is that this policy that they're going to put in place Tuesday sounds to me like the policy that will determine relocation. And if it's not a policy that overrides anything like rezoning for the Seaside Company or rezoning for this or that, or some kind of readjustment to the Third Street alignment that doesn't override that, then it's not a solid policy.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to look. I think we need to show up en masse, and I hope SCAN members are listening, because you know, the SCAN people are the ones that have really been following this the closest. That committee has been doing a good job, and I really, even though you know, I differ with Eric Larson on a lot of things, Eric Larson really has been keeping pretty close tabs on this particular issue. So let's hear what he has to say, if and when he ever does call in, and let's hear what he has to say about how firm this policy is that they established Tuesday. But I would say it's really important that we all show up Tuesday and let them know that we think this policy should be absolutely in stone.
And for those who've forgotten, that's Tuesday, 5 o'clock, City Council Chambers. I suggest people might want to show up earlier.
Yeah, there's a couple other things, too.
3:30 in the afternoon agenda.
There's a coronation of Michael Hernandez as some kind of justice arbitrator.
Yes.
Which, I think should probably be looked at a little closely since he's a lawbreaker. I need to go to this committee to repeal the sleeping ban meeting, and I'm getting ready for that. I'm going to pop by there real quick and drop you off the SCAN newsletter. So I'm in a hurry. Thanks for keeping up the good work, Robert. As you know, I'm going to try to make myself a single-issue person this year. So repeal the sleeping ban. That's it.
Hey, thank you, David Silva.
Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
And the meeting that David Silva is rushing off to is a meeting you too can attend if you're interested in grabbing a petition and helping to circulate these legal petitions that will hope to get the Santa Cruz City sleeping ban repeal on the ballot. Something that we can do if we get more than 5,200 signatures. Actually, we need less than that, but probably more in order to assure that we have the right and legal number of signatures, since you get a large number that are not good signatures. And, of course, City Council stuff is coming up. And there's other stuff coming up in the next week. And there's stuff in the morning paper, actually, if you were following the Santa Cruz Sentinel, that is of interest. And I believe that some of this may be on the council agenda as well, though I couldn't quite find it on the agenda. It's mentioned in the Sentinel story. The Sentinel story, if I could find the right Sentinel, is today's Sentinel, an article by my favorite, Karen Clark. A day's work, Santa Cruz considers a special site for laborers to gather. Plan would reduce crowd at San Lorenzo Lumber. Plan is afoot to develop an acceptable roadside hiring site for the scores of laborers who haunt the River Street entrance of San Lorenzo Lumber Company in hopes of finding a day's work. Advocates of what's being called the Santa Cruz Day Labor Project believe they may have found the perfect site, although its location remains under wraps because negotiations with the landowner are not complete. Former Santa Cruz Mayor Bruce Van Allen will ask the City Council on Tuesday to consider helping fund the project with money from federal grants. I'm not sure whether this is actually on the agenda or will be simply a kind of a request to the council from Bruce Van Allen. We don't want this seen as a polarizing, clean-up-the-area kind of thing, Van Allen said. The atmosphere in the community is one of positive problem-solving and not one of polarizing, scapegoating, or blaming. Van Allen got involved in the project because of his role as executive director of the William James Association, a local nonprofit organization that promotes work, service in the arts, environment, education, and community development. Police Chief Steve Belcher asked Van Allen for the association's help in finding a solution to the makeshift day labor hiring site in front of San Lorenzo Lumber Company. For about 5 years, a growing number of people have gathered each morning in front of the lumber company in hopes of making contact with someone who needs a worker for a day or even a work. They've been gathering there so long that people with odd jobs now simply pull up to the curb into the lot to negotiate a deal. Eric Pitts, a homeless man, has used the San Lorenzo Lumber site to get work for 4 years. I'd use the shelter if it was well advertised, Pitt said Saturday on the sidewalk in front of San Lorenzo Lumber. Many people know they can get workers here once or twice a year, or once or twice a week. This place has great word-of-mouth advertising for both workers and the people who need work done. Finding a more acceptable site would be good news for Doug Lindsay, general manager of the lumber company. It's been really a rugged go, compounded by the fact that 40 to 60 people are there now every morning, Lindsay said. The big thing is there hasn't been another location. I believe they were doing it out at 41st Avenue, and that was broken up by Capitola authorities or the INS or something. Not quite sure what the update is out there. Van Allen, Lindsay, and Councilmember Cynthia Matthews are among those who have served in a special committee for the past year looking for a solution. They've reviewed day labor hiring programs in other cities, investigating such issues as what the INS would play in a formal hiring site. In other cities, Van Allen INS officials have agreed to take a hands-off position. He hopes that will be the case here because many of the workers who congregate in front of San Lorenzo likely are undocumented immigrants. And should a day labor hiring site be developed, officials hoped workers would voluntarily leave the sidewalk in front of the lumber company. If not, however, city codes could be passed that would move them along. Considering such an ordinance, said Matthews, would be a last result, resort. Yeah. Well, Matthews, of course, was a key person in passing the downtown ordinances, has been a key person in maintaining the Santa Cruz City sleeping ban. And I'm not terribly optimistic about Matthews. I mean, it'd certainly be nice to have a place for folks to be able to work out of, but it sounds like they're just trying to get to move people out of this area if they can, which worries me. Rights of association and assembly and all that sort of thing, not to mention the needs of people who need to eat, need to work. I mean, these are... First they tell you, you know, work or you're a scum bum, and they tell you you can't work here. I mean, it's kind of the old story. But well, let's see what happens. Looks like the city council meeting on Tuesday is going to be an interesting situation. Also on Tuesday, by the way, in case you don't go to the city council meeting and you are watching on cable TV, you can switch back and forth from 72, where you can see the council meeting and hear me giving a speech to the council, perhaps, to 71, where Club Cruise goes on the air. Club Cruise is a public affairs show specifically focused on Santa Cruz, usually, and this one is on the beach flats, the issue you heard David Silva talking about, and then later in the show you're going to hear Phil Baer talking about. Phil Baer is a beach flats activist, and you're going to hear him shortly, as soon as we're going to play a little bit more of this Aaron Handel tape. Aaron Handel was a man who is the head of the Berkeley Police Review Commission. We've been listening to him prior last half hour or so. We'll hear a little bit more of that. Then we'll hear something from Phil Baer. I think we may actually go directly to Phil as soon as we can. But Club Cruise plays at 7 on Tuesdays and at 9:30 in the evening on Saturdays. That's Channel 71, and the show this week is going to be about the beach flats, for those of you who want to follow that, in the comfort of your own living room or possibly watching a TV in a department store window if you're outside. You can perhaps imagine what they're saying. Then KKUP, 9 a.m. on Wednesday, that's 91.5 FM, has a show called Purusha's Views. That's a station out of Cupertino which occasionally follows homeless rights topics. I'm going to be talking on that station 9 o'clock Wednesday in the morning on 91.5 on Purusha's Views. Thursday, 4 p.m., St. Stephen's Lutheran's Church will be hosting the monthly talk fest of the Citizens Committee for the Homeless. That's the group that runs the only emergency shelter program in town and is behind the lockout of the homeless from the homeless campground for the last 2 years. Instead, we have in its place a multi-million dollar trailer project that will eventually serve 20 to 40 people if they have checks already to go there. And I guess they're going to get some support from the city as well, the so-called Community House Project. And anyway, CCH's Board of Directors meets 4 o'clock on Thursday. If you want to ask them why there's no shelter now, why don't they support this campaign to end the sleeping ban, which they still refuse to support. Actually, some of the wags on the committee to repeal the sleeping ban, David Silva among them, are going to probably ask the CCH not to support the sleeping ban, thinking it'll be get more popular that way. CCH is currently being sued by the former executive director. Actually, he wasn't an executive director. He was the community house developer and was concerned with safe haven shelters named Frank Pusilik, who was essentially trashed by our friends in the Sentinel and the media and abandoned by CCH. And of interest to me, because he was the only person who ever stood up for homeless shelter on that group who had any power, and he was unceremoniously discarded. Then at 6 p.m. on Thursday at the Civic Center, there will be a free event. Merle Evers Williams, Medgar Evers' widow. Medgar Evers was the man shot dead in the South, the black civil rights leader walking through the South, shot dead, I think it was in 1964 or 65. She's going to be here at the Civic Center Auditorium Thursday, 6 p.m. That's free. And then you can, of course, bring your FM radio with you, and you can tune in to me, because I'll be on the air between 6 and 8 on Thursday. That's when Bathrobe Spears Broadsides reappears at that time, and we'll be getting into that. Well, you know, I think what we may do is we may just simply dump the interview with Aaron Handel. We've really done a lot of it. Let's turn instead to a little bit of Phil Baer, and we also have a little bit of stuff from the streets from Shaz, the Fidget Man. I'm blowing his cover here on the air, and he can probably take me to task for it. He's done a lot of good work lately, and he's been particularly interested in issues of civil rights since police have been kind of removing his civil rights one by one, and his bare stockinged feet as he tried to sleep in his van. Let's follow some of these issues, and let's take a little musical break.
The marketplace was bustling in the morning when the army and the ordnance made their strike. Like a farmer killing chickens for the market, they cut down every living thing in sight. They tore into the wounds of the women, the sunlight gleaming on their bayonets. And the fishermen downstream, though they never heard the screams, hauled in a harvest of human carnage in their nets. Take down my name, I ain't alone, I ain't ashamed, and I say USA, out of El Salvador. You can tell the Pentagon he wants no more Vietnams.
We ain't marching into that jungle anymore.
She left her home in Ohio far behind her. She swore a sacred vow to help the poor. With three sisters she was raped and slowly tortured, left in a shallow grave in El Salvador. The doctor, he would grieve at all the suffering. He never asked his patient's party line, but he saved a rebel's life. The death squad came at night, healing the sick his only crime. Take down my name, I ain't alone, I ain't ashamed. USA, out of El Salvador. You can tell the Pentagon we want no more Vietnams.
We ain't marching into that jungle anymore.
So it's deserts, yes, jungles, no, at the moment. And now let's turn to swamps. Moving on to the beach flat and the swampy scene that's going on down there, we'll hear a little bit from Phil Baer on what we can expect at the upcoming Redevelopment Agency City Council meeting at 5 p.m. on Tuesday. Actually, he's going to report on what happened last Tuesday at the special city council meeting on the Beach Flats.
So you gave us an interview earlier this week, analyzing the possible outcomes at the Tuesday city council meeting around the new Beach Flats redevelopment, Third Street realignment plan, and so forth. You want to give us a sense of what happened at city council meeting on Tuesday night?
Well, it was a public hearing, the first overly long part of which was the presentation by the planning department and the consultants and various other local somebodies of the plan itself to the council and to the public by way of formally opening the period during which time the public has the opportunity to officially get input into the record before the plan is finally readjusted, adopted, discarded, whatever.
And you pointed out to us, the way you described the plan, it was fundamentally, in your view, a giveaway to the Seaside Corporation that allowed further development in the Beach Flats with a few bones thrown down, but actually the prospect of lots of evictions for poor folks in that neighborhood?
Yes, that's essentially my view, and well expressed, I must say there, Robert. That was my premise going to the hearing. A number of people who were able to stay awake through the long presentation did get an opportunity, people from the public, that is, did get an opportunity to express views and ask questions afterwards. That part of the evening, to my way of thinking, confirmed my worst suspicions with regard to the real purpose and impact of the plan. Some serious allegations were leveled at the council regarding the council's failure to even mention, much less do the inadequate kind of study necessary, a study of the overall impact of the boardwalk, which is, of course, the dominant paradigm, the main force that both defines and places the parameters around the potential for the entire main beach commercial area. A lot of people said that when you've got, or several at least, several people said, when you've got an operation like that that plays such a formative role in defining what is occurring in such an area with so many, so much potentiality, then you have to really attempt to say exactly what the impact is. And people alluded to the fact that a number of other such operations up and down the coast in cities like San Diego, Long Beach, Venice, San Francisco, that have since, that once had such amusement parks and closed them, would provide case studies by which the impact of the boardwalk could be estimated. That is to say, you could look at the circumstances that existed in those cities when the amusement parks were in operation and compare those circumstances to the circumstances that existed, say, 5 years after the operations were closed. And the implication was that if one carried out such a study, they would determine that closing the amusement park greatly increased the amount of overall economic activity in the area, really stimulated the local economy, and the blight that seems to almost invariably occur around the periphery of such operations disappeared, in fact, very quickly.
But that, of course, is not the conclusion I take it that the council came to on Tuesday night.
They totally ignored the suggestion, the allegation, and it seemed to me at the time that the allegation may or may not be well-founded, but it was sufficiently significant in its implications to at least warrant some sort of a response, and the council's failure to respond, just sort of gaze up at the ceiling and wait for the speaker's three-minute period and then say, next speaker, please, that sort of failure to respond to such a logically plausible allegation was sort of a confirmation of the validity of the allegation.
Now, let me ask you this. Was there much debate within the council about any aspects of the Beach Flats plan? I know you had said that this plan involved a rezoning for commercial purposes, in essence, sort of...
Half the neighborhood.
Taking about a quarter more of the neighborhood.
Hey, more than that. That is on page 44 of the document, if anybody would care to look at it. That one is rather graphic, and it seems to me irrefutable. All around the outer core, like peeling an orange or something, the entire parameter of the Beach Flats residential neighborhood on every single side, big slices are chopped out and rezoned from residential to commercial, and the combined land area of these various sections amounts to about half of the entire residential Beach Flats. In other words, half of the Beach Flats is being taken out of residential and put into commercial zoning designation.
Now, ironically, when I spoke to Resource Center for Nonviolence activist Eric Larson, He stated that, in fact, this deal would make more residential housing available for folks in the Beach Flats and actually persuade the Seaside Company to release its grip on property that it might otherwise hold for investment purposes. What's your analysis of that?
Oh, I totally disagree, and I don't understand what the conceivable logic would be behind such wishful thinking. The fact of the matter is that in the document, they identify the Beach Flats as being the most densely populated neighborhood in the city of Santa Cruz by a factor of 2 to 3 times. That is to say, the number of people per acre or per land size unit, 2 to 3 times greater than anywhere else in town. Then you lop off huge chunks of the neighborhood that are amongst the less densely populated areas, but are potential residential housing areas. You lop those out, give them over to the commercial interest, and then you take a smaller section and rezone it of the remaining residential neighborhood and rezone it from its present medium density zoning to high density zoning, so that in fact you are shrinking the size of the available land area for residential use. At the same time, you are increasing the allowable densities in much of the remaining residential area. At the same time, you are identifying that you already have the most densely populated neighborhood in town. I don't see how you can do anything other than shrink the neighborhood at the same time you further overcrowd it. I don't get the public benefit.
But if you allow a more dense kind of zoning, doesn't that in fact allow more people to live there, and so theoretically would allow for the building of more low-income residential stuff?
Yes, but you're also increasing the density beyond what it already is, which, as the document identifies, and as anybody who's been down here will tell you, it's already, you know, big city ghetto Calcutta type of densities in terms of how many people are living down here. You're going to increase the amount of people that you allow to live down here. How does that translate to an improvement when overcrowding is the essential problem that you're beginning with?
What would you suggest as an alternative to this plan?
Well, I don't see why in the world you want to take out of a possible housing
lands, large chunks of it, and rezone it over to commercial. What you need is more residentially zoned land onto which you can build. This idea that this plan somehow creates housing opportunity sites is so absurd as to be almost hard to put your finger on it. You're lopping off half the residential neighborhood, yet somehow creating affordable housing opportunity sites. How does that work? That makes no sense.
Did any council members echo your concerns?
Well, my sense is that, I didn't feel that any of them had even bothered to notice the actual zoning changes that were being proposed in the documents. None of them, nobody refuted it. You know, people said, you're taking half our neighborhood and zoning.